You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome. My name is Andy Neal, and you're listening to the Hiker Podcast. Hello, everyone, and thank you for listening to the podcast that gets to know the hikers behind the trekking poles, the podcast that asks the why questions of hiking in the outdoors, the podcast that asks hikers and outdoors persons, how has hiking in the outdoors changed you, and how are you changing the world around you? That's right. You're listening to the Hiker Podcast. Hiker Podcast is brought to you by some amazing sponsors. I do want to first off thank Sawyer Products. You're going to hear more from Sawyer Products here in just a few minutes. They sponsored a block of episodes here, and I'm excited to be working with them. I've had a chance to work with them on some reels, too, on my Instagram. So they have been, they've always been awesome. They were the first sponsor ever of the show. So big up to Sawyer Products. Also, you cannot forget CS Instant Coffee, makers of the best instant coffee on the trail. Ina Monica, always doing amazing things over there at CS Instant Coffee. Go to the link in the description of this episode to get yours. Helps out the show as well. And that's just really, really good coffee. I often use it as my main coffee, like in the morning, like not when I'm on the trail. It's that good. And I'm a huge coffee snob. I say it every week. And of course, you can't forget, you know what it is. Canuck Outdoors, makers of the carbon fiber cork trekking poles. Check them out. They're amazing. Link in the bio. Thank you to all our sponsors for helping us out. And to the Patreons who make this show possible week in and week out. If you want to support the show on Patreon, just go to the link in the description of this episode. Or for all the information about our sponsors and everything, go to hikerpodcast.com. And the music you're currently listening to is on a playlist on Spotify. This song is called Kindred Spirits by Analog Heart. And if you want to listen to this or any of the music that you hear on the Hiker Podcast, I had someone actually message me the other day, like, what song is this on this? And I'm like, go over to the Spotify playlist. It's all there. All the music I have on the show is licensed through musicbed.com, and I put it in a playlist every week on Spotify. A lot of times what you hear is just the music only, no vocals, but I have the vocal version on the playlist on Spotify. That will be in the description of this episode, or just go to hikerpodcast.com, or just go on Spotify, search Hiker Podcast, you'll see the podcast, and you'll see a playlist with all the music week in and week out. If you want to follow us, you know where to go. Follow me at Andy Films and Hikes, or at Hiker Podcast on Instagram. There's a Facebook group. I don't know if many of you know this. Hiker Podcast has a Facebook group. Don't really advertise it too much, but I would love to see more people on there. I would love to see that group grow and thrive as people talk about hiking and how hiking has changed them and how they are changing the world around them. So just search for the Facebook group on Facebook. Just put in Hiker Podcast and groups, and you will find the Hiker Podcast. I am so excited to have our next guest. Dara Blackwater was on the show beginning of season 2. So last year, so excited to have her back on the show. Had an amazing conversation last time, and even more amazing conversation this time. We talk about so many different things, and it's been a journey for me as I have gotten to the outdoors and learned about the land that I'm hiking on and the people who were here before us, and that this land that I'm hiking on was stolen from the indigenous people who were here for millennia before us. And there's so much to learn about what happened, where you're at, where you're recreating, where you're hiking, where you're enjoying the outdoors. Because if you're in North America, you're hiking, you're recreating, on public lands, and it belongs to someone else before you. You are on indigenous land. And I think it's important for us to understand that. And so it was really a great conversation to have with Dara about a number of things, public lands and trauma and so much stuff. And listen through the whole conversation. It was a great conversation. We had a great time. She was recently featured on Vice News and co-produced a documentary about the digital divide on Native reservations as well as spectrum sovereignty. I'd encourage you to check that out. That will be in the description of this episode. And yeah, had a really good conversation, and I'm excited to have her on again. So without any further ado, my conversation with runner, hiker, and advocate, Dara Blackwater.
We're Sawyer, and since 1984, we've been creating technically better solutions for peace of mind in the outdoors. Why? Because we believe everyone deserves to be safe. We believe nature wants to be explored. We believe industry standards should be exceeded. We believe nonprofits deserve some of ours. And we believe the outdoors is a place for community, from the backcountry to the backyard. We're more than an outdoor company, and we believe a thank you is due to anyone who supports our products. Because of you, we spent a decade teaming up with over 140 charities in 80 countries, bringing Sawyer water filtration systems to people in need all around the world. You help us aid refugees, disaster zones, and life-saving efforts around the world, perhaps without even knowing it. So thank you from everyone here at Sawyer. Together, we are saving millions of lives.
One thing I love about this podcast is having guests who've been on before and catching up with them and seeing what they've been up to, not only on the trail and the outdoors, but also with their advocacy work and changing the world around them. And part of this podcast is finding out how the outdoors has changed people and how they're changing the world around them. And one of my favorite interviews I have ever done is with Dara Blackwater. And Dara Blackwater is on the show. How are you doing today, Dara?
I'm so good. That's such a nice compliment.
So just catch everybody up with what you've been up to. You were on first episode of season 2. We're in the middle of season 4 now. Who you are and what you've been up to. Yeah, it's been crazy.
Cool. Well, for all my Diné, my Navajos listening, I'll do my intro. So Dara Blackwater Yinishye, Besh Pachai Nishle, Dodsen Ajini Bashish Chin, Ado Besh Pachai Dashiche, Ado Tajini Dashinale. And that's my clan introduction. So I'm not sure if I explained this last time, but as Diné people, we do our introductions of what clans we're from. And it's just sort of one of those things that when you meet another Navajo or another Native person, you just say, like, you know, this is the people, the community, and the people that I come from. And so mine is Bish Bachayin means like metal hat. My mom is, we would say, Biligana, which is like an Anglo person. She's from like German descendants and Dutch descendants. And in Navajo, they, for some reason, I've heard different reasonings, but they call them metal hat people, German people. And so the metal hat clan is my first clan. And then Tsina Jenny is my dad's mom, and she's from the Blackstreak Wood Clan. She's from St. Michael's, Arizona. And then my mom's dad is Besh Bachayin. He is a metal hat, German descendants as well. And then Tach Ini is Red Running to Water, and that's my dad's dad. And he's from Oljeto, which is Monument Valley. Have you ever been out to Monument Valley, Utah, Andy?
I have not been out there
yet. It's so beautiful.
It's gorgeous area. I know. And it's funny because I lived around there. I was born in Phoenix, Arizona, and I lived in Las Vegas for years. So I never got out there. I was always
Where
around the Grand Canyon.
Now?
I am in Southern Oregon in the ancestral lands of the Takelma people, whose land was taken away in the 1850s. Mm. And they were moved to the tribe in the reservation in the Grand Ronde up in the Willamette Valley called the Rogue Valley Trail of Tears. Very few people know about that. U.S. Army forcibly moved them 300 miles up there. That is my current
I didn't know about that.
Home, yes. So.
Okay. Oregon, I hear, is beautiful. I've never been to Oregon or Washington. I really want to. It's kind of next on my list.
Oh, it's gorgeous up here. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I bet.
Absolutely love it. So you've really kind of been out there since we last time we talked. We talked a lot about spectrum sovereignty and the digital divide. Since mm-hmm. that time, you were on Vice News. You did a doc with Vice News about this yeah. issue on the reservations with the Native people, and how there's just a huge digital divide and this idea of spectrum sovereignty, that there's spectrum on Native land that's owned by the tribes that is being sold by places like Spectrum or Verizon or things like that. And you want that back. Let's talk a little bit about what you've been doing with that in the documentary and that issue a little bit.
Yeah, a few adjustments to that explanation is it's being sold by the Federal Communications Commission, which
FCC,
is the
that's right, yes.
agency of the federal government, but being sold to those entities that you listed. And yeah, so I see it as a natural resource. Spectrum, for anyone who doesn't know, you can think of it just as like radio waves. It's short for electromagnetic spectrum. And you can listen to our first episode. I think I did a thorough explanation there, or you can watch mm-hmm. the Vice video.
I will link that in the description.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Oh, that was such a cool project. Worked with just incredible people. The Vice News crew was really great and we had a really good time. I filmed it also with my cousin, Shandine Herrera, and she lives out at Monument Valley, and she runs the community center out there, which is one of the only places where people out there can get internet, a good internet connection, and, you know, print papers and do whatever sort of legal work or school work or whatever they want to out there. And it saves a lot of people a lot of time and gas money, which is extremely valuable, especially in this climate. So yeah, the Vice videos, it was a cool project and it's out there for the world. I think it's called, well, you're going to link it, so it doesn't matter. But yeah, people can check it out. I haven't looked at it since it published because I made the mistake of reading like 3 comments and I was like, oh yeah, I never want to see this again. But it's a good educational tool for sure. And I'm super stoked that it's out there.
So I was absolutely amazed by that documentary. The lengths people would have to go to get internet. You drive, you know, off the reservation into town to go to find a Starbucks, a coffee house, a
70
library.
Miles people are having miles. To commute. Yeah.
And you're sitting in your car, you know, having lived in Las Vegas and born in Phoenix, Southwest, it's hot. It's hot.
Yeah.
9 months out of the year. And you're sitting in your car. You don't want to have the AC going to, you know, wasting fuel there. So in your car for hours at a time doing your work, you know, work, schoolwork, whatever. Mm-hmm. Just you talk a lot about this in the documentary, but I just want to touch on it a little bit. What work is being done, advocacy is being done to help close this digital divide on Native lands?
I would say that different organizations are approaching it different ways. So there's a lot of lobbying in Congress for more funding. There's a lot of people doing work with the, you know, the incumbents and the players who are already in specific areas, trying to make better deals and educate the incumbents about, you know, what sovereignty is and why it's important to respect sovereignty on Native land, even if the federal government isn't making these, you know, non-governmental agencies or, you know, corporations respect tribal sovereignty, they can still choose to do so if they're operating on tribal land, and to be cooperative with those tribes and allow tribes to benefit from the infrastructure that's on their land or going through their land. So that can mean things like, you know, making a deal to share fiber that's going through tribal land and not just pass by a tribal community, but to split some of that fiber off and create, you know, an opening where the tribal community can benefit from the fiber that's going through their land and different things like that. So, you know, there are 574 at this moment, I think, federally recognized tribes, and then even more non-federally recognized tribes. There's state recognized tribes, and then there's tribes that have never sought any sort of recognition because they're like, we're sovereign and it doesn't matter who recognizes that or doesn't. And then we have, you know, Native Alaskan and Native Hawaiian tribes, or what they don't call themselves tribes, they're nations. And they have completely different political structures and they're having to advocate on completely different levels as well. So, Yeah, it really just depends like where we are, what community we're talking about. And that's where the needs change. That's where the landscape changes, literally and figuratively, as far as what that community needs.
So there has to be done not only on a nationwide advocacy level, but also at the local level, and working not only with the FCC, but with the separate corporations that control the fiber optic lines that go through tribal land, or, you know, through sovereign nations, through, you know, wherever it goes. There's a lot of layers there.
Yeah.
To give them the access that they deserve on their land.
Exactly. Because you also add states into the equations, because oftentimes the federal government will disperse funding through the state governments, and then it's up to the state to fund or not fund tribal projects from there, which sometimes works really great in states that are really cooperative with tribes and have good relationships with their, you know, nation-to-nation relationships. But then there's other states where it's really hostile towards tribes, and they, when they have the purse strings, they're not going to share that and disperse that in a way that's equitable.
And it absolutely flabbergasted me as I watch different documentaries and learn more about these issues with tribal sovereignty, not only with internet, but with also, you know, public lands and controlling public lands that are sacred. People like to make this whole issue a monolith, like, oh, it's tribal issues, you know, public land, fiber optics. But we have to remember, maybe you speak this a little bit, as I've educated myself, you know, I come from a very, very white European background. I'm like, oh, what's happening here, like in the Rogue Valley of Southern Oregon, what happened with the Kelma people is very different than what happened just south of us with the Shasta people and what they've dealt with. It's not a monolith. There's all different kinds of issues with different tribal treaties and the dealing with the states. How does one educate themselves, or would you suggest them educating themselves on what's going on in their local area when it comes to the digital divide and tribal sovereignty and things of that nature, knowing that this isn't an issue that's a catch-all for everyone in the United States?
Well,
I didn't realize that's a very big question. It's a very big question. I know
they're already ahead of the game because they're listening to this podcast. So whoever you are, you're doing a great job already. But I would kind of turn that around to ask you, because I think you almost have a better perspective of how to do that than I do. Like, I'm in it, you know, this is what I eat and breathe every day. But you not being from a native community, but being affected by, you know, being on their land and these things that you've educated yourself, you've come such a long way from, it sounds like, your background. So I'm curious how you've done it and how you continue to do it, and what steps you would suggest other people take to help get them on that path as well.
For myself, and thank you for asking that. It starts with Google. Get on Google and start looking. And there's a lot of good information out there. There's a lot of bad information out there. And it's part of it's, you know, having a sense of digital literacy and media literacy, knowing what good sources and bad sources are. And surprisingly enough, a lot of federal agencies do have a lot of good resources, the Bureau of Land Management. But most importantly, find the tribal organizations in your state and in your area. For so long, I knew, okay, this area was once the tribal homeland, sister lands of the Tecumseh people. And so I'm just sitting there looking for Tecumseh. Where's the Tecumseh tribe? Where's the reservation? What's going on? And then, you know, I take the time and, you know, start reading the signs by the trails of the Table Rocks, which were sacred plateaus to the Tecumseh people along the Rogue River, which was a sacred river, which they did their salmon ceremony every year to bring in the fishing season. I just started reading the signs and educating myself and find out that the Tecumseh people, as a federally recognized tribe, no longer exists. They were brought up to the Willamette Valley and on a reservation with several other tribes in the Northwest. And they were just brought there. And I think there's only six people on earth who actually claim complete Tecumseh heritage. You know, they can take their line back all the way there. 100%. They know that because of what the U.S. Army did with the Rogue Valley Trail of Tears. But that's 2 years of me just researching and finding out because I was wanting to give money to tribal organizations or charitable organizations that work with tribes on the land I was hiking on. And I hiked so much in Southern Oregon. So it just took being relentless and looking and, you know, Googling and even making some phone calls and writing emails and just finding out what happened. Cause all these places are named after, you know, there's Tacoma Gorge and Tacoma Falls and all this stuff, but who are these Tacoma people? No one seems to know. And I'm still learning. I still have a lot to learn. I want to go up to the Willamette Valley and learn more about their heritage and put a spotlight on it, on what's happening on the Rogue Valley Trail of Tears. You know, people think of the Trail of Tears and it was a horrific, terrible, genocidal event. Rogue Valley Trail of Tears, 350 Tacoma people were brought up through Oregon to the Willamette Valley. And very few many people know about that, and just to be able to shine a light on that. But you don't know if you don't look, and you have to be willing to look. And I've found a lot of people who are of white European background, like myself, they suffer from white guilt, and I get that. I understand that, but I don't think anybody wants white people to feel guilty. I think we need to stand up given the privilege that we have and be like, hey, we're hiking, we're recreating, we're living on occupied, stolen land. Let's at least recognize that and learn all we can about it. So that's where I've been, as a white Anglo-Saxon, formerly Protestant person, hiking and advocating for public lands. I just want to learn as much as I can. So you have to want to do it. You can't just do one Google search and be like, oh, can't find anything. Cause that's what I started out doing.
Yeah.
I had to really push and find that information.
Right, because a lot of that information is not readily available.
What I've been
doing, it's buried,
and I have I have a long way to go. Long way to go.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. And it sounds like they do exist, maybe in a different way, and that, you know, we're still talking about them, and so they're still very much in the present. And it's. What's interesting, especially in like Oklahoma, I lived last year in Tulsa, and I learned so much about the different histories of tribes and what Native people look like today, and how it's not always how you would expect Native people to look. And these are huge questions that a lot of tribes are having right now around identity. And, you know, I don't know if you've heard the term pretendian, but it's kind of this phenomenon right now that's happening where people are claiming Native ancestry or Native identity who don't have a right to claim it, and who are doing it for the benefits. And because it's kind of becoming like this trendy, cool thing to be now. Whereas, you know, every year leading up to like these present times, it was not trendy or cool to be Native. It was very dangerous to be Native. And our families survived a lot in order for us to exist here today. And so it's sort of the pretendian thing is sort of like taking the benefits of like being a Native in the present day without any of the negative parts of it and the realness of it that can be sometimes really heart-wrenching. And so what you're talking about is well, let me finish what I'm saying about identity here. These are huge, really existential questions for a lot of Native communities, because what the government did in their policy way back in the day was they created blood quantum. And so this is the idea that you are only a certain percentage of Native. And as Native people, we get asked all the time, well, like, what percent are you? What? How much of an Indian are you? Or like even in court cases, they'll identify people by their fraction of Nativeness. Mm-hmm. And this is completely contrary to the one drop rule for Black people, where for them it was if you are one drop, if you have one drop of Black ancestry, then you are Black. And so for them, policy was multiplying because it benefited rich white people to have a lot more Black people that they could, you know, do enslave and profit off of. And then for Native people, they wanted us to go away. So it became not to multiply us, but to fractionate us until eventually we would become no longer. And so this is the policy that we're now trying to figure out how to frame our policy of identity for Native communities so that we don't disappear, but also retain our, retain that identity, which a lot of people are saying is like very much in the songs that you know, and very much in the language that you speak, and very much in the community that you're brought up in, much more so than blood quantum. You know, you can be, quote unquote, a full native who's never stepped foot on a reservation and never heard a song or never heard the language spoken, which exists because of how many Native people and Native children were taken from their Native communities and adopted out to white families.
Yep.
So then there's these questions of like, okay, if you're quote unquote a full blood Native, but you don't know any of this stuff, what does that process look like to bring you back to this community and reconnect and teach you about what it actually, what your identity as a Native person actually means? And this all sort of gets even more complicated when we're talking about the political status of being Native, because the thing about being, the federal legal term is Indian. So to be an Indian in the eyes of the law, it's not a race-based classification. It's a political classification. So I am a citizen of the Navajo Nation, just like I am a citizen of the American nation, the United States of America, just like a French person is a citizen of the nation of France. And so it's not just about blood and race. It's also about this political identity that we have under these sovereign nations, of which there are, over 500. So it's messy and it's complicated, and these are really big questions that we all have to answer. And then it gets concentrated into these communities, right? And these people in these communities, we all have different stories. And I think the big lie of America is to say, well, it all happened so long ago, nobody really remembers, when like—
Exactly.
We in these Native communities were like, no, we remember. We know
generational
names.
Trauma. There's all that. There's stories absolutely. That were passed down. Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. And so wherever you are, wherever you're sitting in America at this moment, there are stories about that place. And there is a history. Maybe it's an oral history. And maybe that's something that needs to be recorded and protected. Or maybe that's something that people just want to keep with them. And these are things that you don't know until you start asking the questions that it sounds like you've been asking. And there's not a lot of resources. The American education system completely fails us when it comes to a true history of, what happened in America and what the policies were to promote genocide and completely eradicate, and then to remove and then to terminate Native peoples. And that's still, pieces of that are still ongoing today. So yeah. To understand how these big policies affect your area and listen to what the stories are in that area, I think is so important.
Exactly, and every area is different. Every geographical place is different. One thing I think it's important to point out is the educational system in the United States has completely failed our youth and educating on what happened here. Only education I got on what happened with Native Americans was Custer Last Stand. And I went to a conservative evangelical Christian private school. So that perspective was also very, very skewed that Custer was a good guy. I had a lot of unlearning to do when I left that culture.
Sure.
But even in the public school setting, they talk about it, but then that's like all that happened. Like Custer's Last Stand. Yeah. Blah, blah, blah. Like my own kids, they learned this. And I'm like, there's so much more to this.
Oh my gosh.
And we have to educate our children, no matter who you are or where you come from, about the land that we're on. With that said though, I want to talk about something you've been passionate about lately, Oak Flat, yeah. And protecting those public lands and what's been going on. And it's an issue that we've seen, especially in the Southwest, with developers coming in and wanting to mine and do all kinds of things. Talk about your advocacy work for Oak Flat.
Sure. So I'll give kind of a 10,000 foot view of it. And then if anybody wants to learn more, you can Google it and learn, you know, exactly what's happening with the policy and what you can do to take action and support. But yeah, talking about land and, you know, being on the land and running, this was the most recent run that I've done, which was so cool. So there, we had a gathering last month at Oak Flat. And for anyone who doesn't know, Oak Flat is land in Arizona. It's north of Phoenix, not too far from where you're from, Andy. And it's just this beautiful, beautiful land. And there's all these copper mines in that area. It's a very copper rich part of our country. And Oak Flat is a place that is sacred to the San Carlos Apache tribe. It's where they go to do their women's ceremonies, where girls become women. And so this is a really special place to those people. And what has happened is that the United States Congress transferred that land to this company called Resolution Copper. They're a mining company. They obviously mine copper. And they want to blow this place up to mine the copper and essentially turn this place into a sinkhole that will sink, I think it's like 800 feet down into the ground. So this place will no longer be, you know, this what it's been for thousands and thousands of years, the sacred place where the San Carlos Apache can go to do their ceremonies for their girls to become women. So, you know, there's demonstrations, and what we were doing was this demonstration where there were, it was a solidarity run where indigenous runners were coming in from, well, indigenous and non-indigenous runners were coming in from all four directions. So people came from Flagstaff, from Globe, from Phoenix, and from Tucson. And I went to law school down in Tucson, down at U of A, and I was invited by some of my friends who are down there. They're Pascuayaki and Tahana Otham, and they invited me to run up from the south with them. And so they ran, I think, for about a day and a half. I think it was 80 miles that they ran. And I joined just for the last bit. You know, I was like Paul Rudd finishing Friends or something, where I was like, we did it. But yeah, so we went all the way, and it was incredible. We camped once we got there. They fed us. It was this beautiful gathering of speakers and music and dancing together, and we just really got to enjoy that space, pray in that space. And I had heard about Oak Flat. My second year of law school, I was out in Washington, D.C. working for a federal Indian law firm, and I actually got to work a little bit and do some research on the Protect Oak Flat bill. And there have been a couple different bills and updates to try to save this land. And I don't know actually exactly. I studied up on it before I went there, and everyone will have to go and read about it to learn exactly where they are now. But yeah, it's a really important issue, and just it really like it got me, like, just to understand the importance of a place like that. And if we take from it, then it will just never be the same. And yet that's balanced against, you know, this movement toward green energy. And, you know, copper is a great conductor, semiconductor, and that's exactly what we need to create, like, these electric cars to and use greener energy and do what everybody is wanting us to do to combat climate change. And yet this is the cost, and who's bearing it? The San Carlos Apache tribe. And so it's really complicated. I don't have any answers. I just have, you know, what is in my heart, which is all this messiness to sit with.
And this is an issue that, especially in the Southwest, we see happening all over tribal lands, where a developer will want to come in. There is a resource there. There's whether it's a precious metal or tourists dollars or whatever, come in and extract something from the land that belongs to Native people, that belongs to the people who've occupied that land for, you know, millennia. So if on that issue particularly, but what are some things that anyone can do to help advocate for things of that nature, like Oak Flat, to tell their, you know, representatives, this is not something that we support. It's not something that needs to happen. What are some things, steps that the average everyday person can take?
Oh, that would definitely just be reaching out, make yourself familiar with who your senators are, who your state representatives are, and just, you know, let it be known. Just let them know that you support the Protect, I think it's called Protect Oak Flat Bill. I'll send you a link to the website. I think there's sort of a centralized place where they have all their information and, you know, figure out how to organize and how to help. And it's called, I think it's called Apache Stronghold, but I'll send it over to you.
Awesome. Thank you so much. So Dara, what else do you have going on? You know, you've completed law school. You're constantly advocating for, you know, spectrum sovereignty and the digital divide and all of these issues. What does the next year to 5 years look like for you as a person who loves the land and the outdoors, as a person who's advocating for equality and tribal rights? What does the future look like for you right now?
That's such a great question that I'm not going to answer because I can't yet. But I will say what the next week looks like for me, which is a plug for the next project I'm working on to support the Native Community Health Network. So when I was out at Oak Flat, they have all these devil's claw. Do you know what a devil's claw is?
I saw your post about it, yeah.
They're so cool and so like crazy and beautiful. If you don't know what it is, Google it for the listeners. But I picked up a few of these devil's claw and I just think that they're so beautiful and so cool. So this is kind of a full circle thing for me because the reason that I went to law school in the first place was because I was working out in a small community. It's called Denahotso on the Navajo Nation. And this was, I was done with my bachelor's, but I was sort of just spinning my wheels and I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I was doing a little bit of social work. And so I was teaching a teen outreach program out in Denahotso. And because it was a state-funded program by the state of Arizona, we had to do it the way that we had to teach our children the way that they told us to, which was for the sex ed part of this program, we had to teach it abstinence only, was like, you don't get to tell them anything. You don't get to talk about birth control. You know, you can't tell them about condoms or the pill or any sorts of options. And it really bothered me because so many of these kids were already sexually active and it was so obvious that they were just blowing us off. And it's because we weren't respecting them by giving them a real education. And abstinence-only sex ed empirically just does not work and can actually have the opposite effect. So it just didn't make any sense. I felt like I was wasting my time. I felt like I was wasting their time. And I was frustrated. I didn't know at the time, but what I was frustrated about was this idea of what we were doing was lacking self-determination. And self-determination and sovereignty kind of go hand in hand. Self-determination is the policy era of the federal government that we are in regarding Native nations, where, you know, they essentially over the years realize like, okay, well, we can't eradicate them all and we already moved them, but they have to be there and we can't terminate them as tribes because we have all these treaties. So now I guess we're going to go into the self-determination era where they get to determine whatever, you know, they get to have the sovereignty with limits and the determination to, you know, educate their kids and do their law enforcement and do whatever they want with their land. And education is a huge part of that because for so long, our kids were taken away to boarding schools where, you know, they were very much abused and indoctrinated with a lot of doctrines of Christianity and all of these things that Native nations have never subscribed to before settlers arrived here. And so education is huge because to be able to educate our kids the way that we want to is really, really important for our future, especially coming back to what I said about identity and language and songs and all that sorts of sort of information. And so what I was feeling when we weren't allowed to educate our kids the right way, you know, thoroughly, what it was this lack of self-determination and lack of sovereignty. And when I realized it was because it was grant funded and, you know, the money and look at wherever the power is, the money is, I realized like, okay, I'm probably going to have to go to law school to make the kinds of changes that I want in this world for my people. And so that's really what took me to law school. And when I was looking at this Devil's Claw out at Oak Flat and sitting in this place that is so significant to women and so significant to, you know, our future, these like women become girls becoming women and eventually possibly, you know, bearing the people who will continue on and become our future. The Devil's Claw really, it looks like a uterus, and I just think it's so cool. And so what I want to do is I created a block print. I'm going to finish it today, actually. So I'll probably post about it later today or tomorrow when this comes out. And I'm going to block print it onto probably bags. I did it last week, or not last week, last year I did this fundraiser, but I did it on t-shirts, which was a little bit difficult. So this year I'm going to do it on bags. And it's going to support the Native Community Health Network. And what they do is essentially they're geared toward working with indigenous communities in the Southwest, sexual health, reproductive justice, education, advocacy, outreach, you name it. They're doing all this incredible work that benefits largely women, but everyone in these Native communities. And so I'm going to print this carving that I made out of a devil's claw and put it on bags and sell those. People can purchase them until they're sold out. And that money will go to the Native Community Health Network. And so that's the big project that I'm working on currently.
That is so awesome. And yeah. We'll make sure we link to where you can get to those. And if just closing out, if somebody wanted to follow what you were doing, everything that you're up to, where would they go?
Mostly on Instagram. I do have a website, blackwatersoul.com, and that has all my videos. I did a big run in Creed, Colorado last year, and you can see my vlog doing that run. I felt like I was going to die. I'm sure you felt that before too, Andy, on some of these hikes, especially with altitude. But yeah, there's a lot of fun stuff up there. I have a question for you before we go.
Sure.
I am interested in hearing you talk about, one, the experience of, because you've gone viral since we last spoke, video that made me laugh out loud. I loved it so much about going on a stupid hike for your stupid mental health. And so I'm curious, one, about like your journey with mental health or your thoughts about that and what it's been like to bring that to the forefront of conversation. And I'm sure there's kind of two sides to that coin. I'm just kind of curious, like what the whole journey's been like.
You are always the only interviewee who interviews me back, and I love it. I absolutely love it. So the whole thing has been kind of insane because I've always loved social media. I've worked with brands. Before I went viral, I'd worked with Columbia and Eddie Bauer, and I've worked for different organizations for as like a social media manager. So something I've always just loved doing. And I just made this video. It's in this area I just love. It's a beautiful area. I just love to sit there. It's got this little mile loop. I drop my daughter off. She goes to a charter school. I drop her off. And then I just go drive there before I hit my day and just kind of, you know, reset, prepare myself for the day. And I saw this trend, it was a stupid walk. Going for a stupid walk for my stupid mental health. I'm like, well, I can do that for hiking. And I'm just like, oh, well, I'll just drive there. I have my tripod, my camera with me. I'll just go do it real quick. And I posted it. And then before I got back into town, because we're out in the wilderness a little bit, it got 10,000 views in like 20 minutes. I'm like, oh my gosh. And then before you know it, I'm at stinking like 37 million, and I got news people calling me. And so that it was just insane because you have all these people just calling you and wanting to talk to you and your attention, all of a sudden your followers go through the roof. And I had all these plans before, you know, and now it's like, well, I get to use and leverage this opportunity to provide for my family, have more flexibility. But as far as the mental health aspect of it is concerned, I'm a huge advocate for saying it's okay that I'm not okay. I've struggled with anxiety and depression. I come from a background of my mother was my mother abused drugs, that deeply affected me, Child Protective Services was involved. So that was that those things deeply affected me. And then as most listeners know, I was a pastor for 15 years. And when I came out of my Christian upbringing and background and my career, and I left all that, there was just this huge, just kind of gaping existential hole in my life where all these big questions in my life I thought I had answered were no longer there. I was doubting everything. So, and that's when I started going to counseling and going to therapy and dealing with past traumas and just trying to figure things out. And I tell this story a lot where I'm talking with my therapist and I'm talking to her about, you know, just kind of the big existential questions, like, why are we here? Why were we created? I had all these answers before. I taught these answers before. I mean, you talked about absence only education. I was a huge, my first 10 years of being a youth pastor, I was a huge advocate of absence only education and silver ring thing, true love waits, all that stuff.
I had one.
Oh, I did too. I did too. But my last 5 years, I really was like, oh wow, this isn't working. Like, we're actually hurting kids. That silver ring is becoming their shame ring now. And and that's part of the reason why I slowly started backing away. Cause I'm like, what I'm teaching isn't working for me, and it's definitely not working for these kids. So dealing with that, and she has suggested, you know, try going in the outdoors, try going on a hike. And it was just kind of a passive thing. And I did it and just fell in love with hiking in the outdoors and how healing the land has been for me, how healing the outdoors is. And I tell people all the time that, you know, hiking in the outdoors doesn't take the place of therapy. You know, don't go for a hike and stop taking your medication. Don't do those things. You know, work with your counselors, your therapists, your whoever it is you work with, what you do. But the outdoors has been very therapeutic for me and very healing for me. And so having also adopted 3 kids from foster care, 2 with high trauma, high special needs, who have severe mental health and trauma impacts from the abuse they suffered before they came into our home. I'm seeing how sickening and horrible our mental health care system is in the United States. And my wife, she has a master's and bachelor's degree in education, and she is constantly on the phone. Right before this, we were on the phone with you know, special ed people and, you know, their counselors and therapists trying to get them the therapy they need. And it's just an impossible labyrinth of things to unwrap and red tape to cut through. And my wife is, you know, she took college classes on how to deal with special education and, you know, childhood development and dealing with trauma. And so I just super passionate about the healing effects of the outdoors. It's the one place where I've seen my 2 oldest kids who have the mental health issues and the trauma. I've seen them, I use this in air quotes, act normal when they're in the outdoors, when we're camping, when we're backpacking. That's when I see them at themselves.
They're thriving.
I see who they're thriving. Yeah. And so I'm just a huge advocate of, and want to push out, it's okay to not be okay. And the outdoors, the land is so healing. And that's also led me to, you know, discovering, you know, more about the land that I'm hiking on. You know, conversation I had with you a year ago has led me down that path as well. And it's like, wow, the people who were on this land millennia before us knew that, and they've known that. Things like the wildfire issues we're having in this area. Our local county government are going to the native people here and like, how do we deal with this?
Yeah.
And they're like, we've been dealing with this for a while. We need to do some prescribed burn. You know, we've been doing this before you got here. And then you guys just started screwing everything up, and whole city of, you know, Phoenix, Oregon and town, Oregon got burned down because our fire management, we didn't listen to the people who were here before us.
Yeah. I have a couple plugs on that issue. I have this podcast, it's called Determination, DETERMI-Nation. And it's, again, coming back to the concept of self-determination. And this one interview, everyone go listen to this. It's one of my favorite ones. But I interviewed this woman from the Yurok tribe, and she's on their Cultural Fire Management Council. Her name is Elizabeth.
That's near here. Yeah.
And so she is partially in charge of doing these burns and educating people about it. And she was talking about the history of burns and how they were not allowed, they were totally outlawed for Indigenous people to do burns. And when she was a kid, her elders would send her to go do it because they didn't think that they would shoot a kid who was starting a fire. But if an adult was doing it, they would shoot him. And that has completely changed in her lifetime, thankfully, with her advocacy and others. They've turned it around where now they're actually getting grants from Cal Fire and working with Cal Fire and educating them about how to manage the forest that, like they've been doing, like you said, for thousands and thousands of years. So yeah, it's called Determination. That episode is Elizabeth Azuz. And then the other thing, I don't think that we fully went into all of this, but I remember the last conversation we had, I was like, oh my God, we're such kindred spirits because of my background with the church and the religious trauma that I've sustained in my life. I finally put that on paper. And so at Blackwater's, well, figurative paper, blackwatersoul.com, there's a tab that's, I think I called it Healing While Indigenous, or maybe I changed it to Thriving While Indigenous. But that's my blog where... last year, last summer, I had a total meltdown. And like hearing about your wife being an advocate and, you know, showing up for your children in that way is so amazing. But I also understand how hard it is, even when you have a degree in whatever it is you're trying to do. Yeah. You know, I was trying to get help. I've taken antidepressants different times in my life to get me through certain eras. And last summer was one of those. I went through this really awful breakup. And then, like you said, like all these doors start opening where it's like, oh, that's shit I've never dealt with. Oh, that's trauma that I've never touched before. Oh, there's that. Okay. And I hit the point last summer where I didn't think that I wanted to live anymore. I didn't feel like I wanted to live anymore. And I was trying to get myself help. And it was so hard. You know, I don't have insurance because as Native people, we're supposed to have health care through Indian Health Services. It's a treaty right that we have. But it can just be so bad. The service and the how far out you have to schedule an appointment can be so detrimental. So I was trying to get myself help. I have a law degree in this sort of stuff. And it was still so, so hard. And so, you know, for people who aren't as equipped or aren't as familiar with how systems work and how to advocate for themselves or others, I can't even imagine what that would be like. So to read more about that, and finally I got myself help. I started with BetterHelp, and then I got a therapist eventually through Indian Health Services, and then now I have someone else who's fantastic. But to read kind of about that journey of like opening up my own religious trauma and looking at abuse that I sustained through a youth minister when I was in high school it helped me so much, but it was so hard. And I wrote it in a blog called, I think, like I said, I think it's called Healing While Indigenous. It's on my website, blackwatersoul.com. But yeah, every time we talk, I feel like we have so much more to talk about.
So. And you talk about that because I think I've shared with you, my grandparents were missionaries on reservations for years. And I spent my junior high and high school years near Chandler, Arizona and Casa Grande on the Pima reservation. Every summer I'd spend there and, you know, try to evangelize the natives. And you know, like, and my grandfather's passed, and he was a missionary and pastor. I truly believe he loved the people there, but you know, anytime we spoke about, you know, the different rituals that were going on there, or sweat tents, he'd call them, it was just very negative, and we need to bring him Jesus. And I was like, no. And just having that perspective, like, wow. And never realizing the damage that was happening when I was there amongst it. And then looking back now, it's like, wow, it's just so much healing that needs to happen. And
I went down to, I did mission trips with this church group in high school, and we went down to New Orleans. And I think about that now, and I'm like, I was an Indigenous girl going to colonize Black people in poor communities in New Orleans. And I'm just like, whoa. Yeah. Healing is happening.
Yes. On the other side of the question, though, there's two parts to your question. I think the social media stuff of it, it's been crazy weird, because you talked about earlier, you read the comments on that doc you did. That has been both like 95% of what I get have been very positive, and I love the DMs and messages I get about from people who aren't stereotypical outdoors persons who said, you know, I saw your reel and just encouraged me to get outside, or encouraged me to go, you know, go for a walk, go for a hike. And then you get the other side of it. It's like people, I don't know where they're coming from. And I know. I'm like, what on earth? Everything from, you know, my appearance to, oh, you're just a snowflake. You're just a left coast snowflake. Mm. Why do you keep, I've never used to get criticism for putting land acknowledgements, which I do on all my posts. I get harped on for that all the time, but I'm not complaining about that. I'm white Anglo-Saxon, formerly Protestant. I can take a little bit of criticism for people, you know, not liking my land acknowledgements on there. but it's just like, the vitriol, and I see, and I understand why so many people who go viral, just get offline completely after a while. They just, the mental health, implications of it is just enormous, knowing, you know, I can't walk through Ashland, Oregon anymore without being stopped, which is fine. I love it. And if you're listening to this, please stop, say hello. I'm all about it. I'm totally cool with that. But it's just like, there's a weird side of it that I'm still coming to grips with. Yeah. Cause I always get, oh, you're that hiking guy. I'm like, oh, hi. So that's weird when, you know, 37 million people have seen you looking like a dork hiking on what is sacred land? There's signs there that show it's sacred land to the Tacoma people, and you know, just encouraging people to get outside for mental health. So it's been weird. It's been crazy.
Yeah, it is strange. And I just try to stick to, like, there are so many people that have been following me for years on Instagram who are just like so lovely. You know, they'll send me nice things, they'll say nice things to me. And those are the ones that I really like am so encouraged by. And that's really kind of who I'm doing it for at this point, where, like, I've heard different talk show hosts and celebrities say, like, they just never read comments. They don't read reviews. They don't read comments. Yeah. And I think that's the way to do it, because it is, it's rough out there.
I just have to been coming to the realization that I've been given a platform, and I can advocate for public lands and mental health and do good things with it, and also have an opportunity to provide for my family. So that's what I'm going to do. And it's been crazy. And it's been a wild ride. I feel like we can talk for another hour, and I'm going to have you on the show again. We'll talk about
it. I know. Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm super thankful for what you do. I'm super thankful for how you're utilizing your platform, and I'm super thankful to be here. So thanks for having me. Yes.
Thank you. And I do want to thank you. Our first conversation, I alluded to this earlier, really kind of got me on the path, because you had challenged me to kind of discover what's going on with the tribes and native lands around me for myself. Because I came into our first conversation thinking of it more as a monolith, more as just a one issue, a one size fits all solution. And you challenged that for me, which really set me on a path of discovering the people and lands around me and everywhere I go. So I want to thank you for that. And I challenge all the listeners to do the same, wherever you're hiking, wherever you're recreating. I mean, even if you're going to stinking Disneyland, I have posts from Disneyland. You know what? That was native land at one point. Before it was Disneyland, it was orange fields. Before that, it was belonged to native people. Find out what's going on. So,
yeah. And I also, like, I hope people can take that challenge as like something kind of exciting. Like, it's almost like being a detective or something, where it's really cool history. Like, it's really cool information. When it starts to click, this full picture of like who these people are and were, and how they've lived and what made sense and how cool it is. You know, it's actually a really fun process. And I hope that people can, I hope that they can enjoy it. And I hope that they can allow themselves to feel whatever they feel and be okay with that. And just know that, you know, it's natural. And if you're feeling, it's because you're probably like learning and things are clicking and you're getting it. And that's awesome.
Exactly. Exactly. Dara, thank you so much for coming on the show. And everybody make sure
thank you, Andy.
Follow her in all the various social places, and all the links will be in the description.
Cool. I can't.
As always, thank you so much for listening through the entire episode. Make sure you follow everything Dara is doing. Check out her Instagram. She's doing amazing work. Also, if you want any information about this week's episode, you can go to hikerpodcast.com, hit podcast. All the show notes, all that fun stuff is there. And make sure you check out our sponsors. You know who they are. CS Instant Coffee, Canuck Outdoors, and Sawyer Products. They make this show possible, make it possible that I can spend time to produce and record these episodes. And I'm so thankful for them. As we're getting into springtime, guys, and you're going to be outdoors, I talk about mental health a lot. We talked about mental health on this episode quite a bit. And the outdoors and moving your body can do amazing things. Connecting with land and spending time in the desert, in the forest, on the shore is so healing. And I always want to emphasize to people, while being in nature, forest bathing, hiking, walking through a park, it does not take the place of therapy. It does not, it will not take the place of medication maybe you're on or treatments you're doing. It will, and it is therapeutic, and it has been for me. I've dealt with anxiety for a number of years. I had panic attacks on the regular, and at the suggestion of a therapist, I tried hiking in the outdoors, and it changed my life. It hasn't cured my anxiety, but it is a tool in my toolbox to help cope and deal with anxiety, and I am so thankful for it and for what it's done for me and my family. So I know a lot of times, as we talked about in this episode, getting mental health services is difficult. And if you can get them, if you are struggling, there is help. And if you can get them, I'd encourage you to. But also, the outdoors is an amazing tool to help you in coping with so many different things that we deal with, because there's so much stuff going on. We're coming out of a pandemic, so it would seem, fingers crossed, life has changed over the last 2 years. Life as we know it has changed, and It's there's a lot to deal with, and the outdoors is a very healing and therapeutic place that has done wonders for me. So that's my 2 cents for today. Make sure you follow me at Andy Films and Hikes. You can go to hikerpodcast.com for all the information about what's going on with the show. If you want to help the show out, you can go to Patreon. Link for that is in the description. And without anything else to say, I will bid you adieu. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Hiker Podcast.